You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Here's an email. Matt, where are the podcasts from yesterday? They're not showing up on the website or in the Apple podcast app. I know, I was sick yesterday. I went back to bed. Sorry about that. So I'll get them up here in a little bit. Yeah, no kidding. I went back to bed and slept from like 11 in the morning till out here until 5 in the afternoon. Then got up and went and got Colleen. I'm distracted right now, but I just saw the headline on Fox News. The city council in St. Louis Park, Minnesota, which is a northern suburb of Minneapolis, either adopted a rule or considered adopting a rule. I guess they adopted a rule where they will not recite the Pledge of Allegiance anymore. They'll not recite the Pledge of Allegiance anymore. Right? Because I don't even know what the reason is, right? Is it racist? What is it? Hold on, let me Saint L O U Lewis Park, Minnesota Pledge. All right. How Minnesota cities handle the Pledge of Allegiance. St. Louis Park Pledge of Allegiance controversy gains the president's attention. St. Louis Park City Council to reevaluate the Pledge of Allegiance changes. Let's see. Who do you want? Star Tribune. Star Tribune. St. Louis Park will no longer say the Pledge of Allegiance. This is June 27th. Like, are you kidding me? The St. Louis Park City Council has decided to drop recital of the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag at its meeting, citing a desire to accommodate the city's newest and more diverse residents. What? Like, come on. You can't make this shit up either, man. This is amazing. So somehow or other, the Pledge of Allegiance alienates who? Quote, this is like comedy, right? I hope it's not too controversial, Councilmember Tim Browsen said. Our community tends to be very welcoming and increasingly diverse community, and we believe our citizens will understand. I don't think we're going to be less welcoming by not starting our meeting out with the standard ritual. The measure, which will take effect on July 15th, was sponsored by Councilmember Ann Mavity, who said that about half the cities in Minnesota do not require the pledge of allegiance to be said at council meetings. However, a spot check of metro and outstate cities found that most of them, Blaine, Brooklyn Center, Burnsville, Duluth, Eden Prairie, Mankato, Maplewood, Rochester, St. Cloud, St. Paul, Stillwater, Wayzata, include the pledge as part of their council meeting agendas. The pledge is not said at city council meetings in Minneapolis or Edina. The St. Louis Park Council voted 5-0. They voted unanimously at the June 17th meeting to drop the pledge with little discussion. That meant the fix is in. That's what happens. I know, right? It comes up, it's an agenda item, right? McNamara seconds it, right? We call the vote. All in favor say aye. Any discussion? No. Done. Quote, "We all love our country dearly, and we demonstrate that by our service as elected officials all the time," Mabity said. "I want to make sure that we are welcoming to everyone in our community. And so I just felt that it was unnecessary, an unnecessary component to include every single week in our work." This shit's amazing to me. Let's see. St. Louis Park resident Dennis Moran said he and his neighbors were surprised by the council's decision. Moran, who described himself as an old school DFLer, what's DFL stand for? Democrat Farmer League, something like that. So the council didn't specify whether any complaints had been received about the pledge. Quote, "It's always been a tradition here since I've been watching city council meetings back in the 80s. They've always done the Pledge of Allegiance. It's kind of automatic or traditional," Patty Carlson said. Another resident, her grandparents wanted to be Americans when they immigrated to the United States. She said she didn't understand how the council could eliminate this part of their history, calling it obnoxious. "My fear for this council is that it's all about image and not substance," she said. The measure was on the consent agenda, with other items to be approved without debate. Before Brousen pulled it off the consent agenda, he said, to ensure transparency. See, that's how scummy politicians are, right? They knew there would be an outcry. So they debated it offline, and they said, "Hey, we're going to do away with it. We'll put it on the consent agenda." But this dude, Brousen, he pulls it from the consent agenda and screws everybody over, right? So then they talked about it. He said he didn't recall having any complaints about the pledge. But added that the meaning behind the tradition has changed since 1980 when city officials began saying the pledge during the Iran hostage crisis. "Unfortunately, some of us feel like patriotism has been so politicized that it's almost used as a weapon against people," he said. Quote, and he goes on, "If we have an opportunity, an appropriate opportunity, if we have Boy Scout color guards or others in attendance, or if it's a special occasion, we will consider using the Pledge of Allegiance before the meeting." Man. Yeah. So, saying that you pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States as an elected official, that's now too much. Okay. Whatever. Anyway, St. Louis Park. What a bunch of bozos. Alright. Honestly, it's unbelievable. Oh. I shouldn't really combine these things, but I'm going to. Fuck it. Last night I was reading an article in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Where did I find this article? It had to deal with James Monroe. And I've spoken about the bleaching of American history. And see if I can find it. And it had to do with Monroe had over 250 slaves. They have settled in a small community outside of his estate in Virginia that's called, I think, Monroeville or something like that. And so, But the reason that it caught my attention as I read the article I'm going to find it here in a second. Because, yes, here it is. It's in the New York Times of all places. It's entitled, James Monroe Enslaved Hundreds, their defendants still live next door. And the story is how the Monroe Foundation, I want to say, which is actually his home is owned by William and Mary University, is that what it is? How they are now going to tell the story of the slaves that he owned. They're not going to bleach history. They're not going to tear it down. And we've talked about this on this program when we talk about, you know, the whole issue of bleaching, you know, your history. That's what the Chinese do. Right? There is no more Tiananmen Square because they don't want you to talk about it. Right? So when you take those statues down and you throw them away and you don't tell the story, you don't tell your story. You don't tell the truth. That's not the American way, in my opinion. It's the bullshit political way of stupid people. So, to me, there's better ways of doing it. And this article in the New York Times talks about that. And so, I'm trying to be able to read the article, but New York Times, the communists that they are, they won't let me. All right, here it is. But I told you there's ways to get around it. You have to have more than one browser. So you have the Microsoft browser. You have, what's this one? Opera has a browser that's pretty decent. Firefox has a and so you can read read 10 articles a month with a free account, so you can read for 10 articles a month. Yeah, so there's like 40 articles a month. Who needs more of the New York Times than that? Anyway, but the story's interesting, right? The sub headline says, a small African-American community has existed less than 10 miles from the president's former plantation for generations. Only recently has the full extent of their relationship been revealed. So, and what, So, I'll put the link in this hour's podcast, right? You can find this, you can find the link. And if you don't subscribe to the New York Times and you've read less than 10 articles so far this month, you'll be able to read it. All right, now, so it talks about these descendants from slaves that Monroe owned, right? And so what the foundation is going to do is they are going to begin to tell their story, who they were, where they came from. So he sold families, right? He did not believe in selling individuals. If he was going to sell, he would sell a family, which, again, slavery is not outlawed in the world until 1831. So, again, my problem is that the 2019 lens, right, fired into a time, what, over 240 years ago in our nation's history, and then now we're going to judge people. You can't do that, right? And tell your history. And so, again, the cool part about this is, right, nobody's clamoring to burn down James Monroe's estate, right? Tell the story. He was a slaveholder. This is where they came from. These are the people that he sold. And they went to a plantation in Florida and were later emancipated after the war. And they know that because they track names in the census. Yada, yada, yada. Oh, that brings me to another point about the census. Don't let me forget about that. We'll get to Stafford, his speech. All right. But I think it's the article documents how you should do this. A blueprint for don't bleach your history. Tell the whole story. Now, again, I always say this. I don't believe that if you have a Confederate statue in front of the courthouse, I don't believe it should stay there. And if your community's got an issue with it, take it down, move it to the side grounds of the courthouse, and then build an additional monument to the people in the community that were enslaved. Tell that story so that when people come, they can see the whole story. This statue was originally not allowed after the war. In an effort to bind the wounds of the nation, there was a compromise, and they were allowed to put these statues up. Okay? This statue has remained in front of our courthouse until 2000, yada, 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 during which time it was removed. As we now are more sensitive to Confederate statues in front of federal and public buildings. It has been moved here, and we built the additional whatever, kiosk, diorama, or whatever, that chronicles the lives of the slaves that were brought to this county, that were sold in this county, that lived in this county, were freed in this county, blah, 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 blah. And I think this article does that very well. So, it's about enlightenment. Let me just tell you this. I'll make this statement about the census. The census, I did some reading after the show yesterday, right? The census is absolutely, right? It's probably most important tool is that it is used to carve up political power. That's how it works. That's how it works. So if we're going to use that to carve up political power, how do you not ask if somebody are you a citizen or not? Because we don't carve up power, right, for people in the country illegally under any circumstances. You're not a citizen. Power is defined as citizens. So to me, the president's getting accused of, well, he wants the question on there for political reasons, right? Well, wait a minute. The question's always been in our censuses, except for what, 2010, I think? Why was it taken off? Was that for political reasons? Now, the stated reason might have been, and again, I ascribe the same motives to both sides. So Trump wants it off for political reasons. What about the people that wanted it off? What was their reasons? Well, we want a more complete count. I don't believe that for a second. I believe the people that wanted that question off wanted it off for one reason. Right? We get more people that are illegals in these sections of these cities. Guess what that means? More Democratic power. Right? Now, I don't know if it actually falls that way. But that's, in theory, that's the way it would work, yay? But there's no political motivation ascribed to that. Oh, no, that's just better. I mean, come on. If everybody doesn't believe that the thing that motivates change in this country is politics, you're crazy. But we won't ascribe it to one group, but we will ascribe it to another group. That's crazy, too. They both operate in the same realm. They come from the same bloodlines. They're just on different teams. That's the way the game is played. Oh, Mac. Yeah, I know. So anyway, now, this got sent to me recently, and I haven't played it. So in an hour of kind of potpourri, we may not get to the Confederate artillery. No, I mean the Union artillery's performance in at Gettysburg. Or we might. Let me just tell you. So this happened on there's no date with it. Within the last 30 days. All right. Now you're going to hear the whole ceremony. So this is the the Medal of Honor flag presentation to United States Army Staff Sergeant David G. Bellavia. Okay. He's no longer on active duty. Right. And, I think he does a radio talk show if I'm not mistaken. So he's presented a flag as a Medal of Honor recipient. And so, you're going to hear the ceremony. So, stand by.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain seated during the presentations. The President of the United States of America, authorized by Act of Congress, March 3rd, 1863, has awarded, in the name of Congress, the Medal of Honor to Staff Sergeant David G. Bellavia, United States Army, for conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity at the risk of his life above and beyond the call of duty. Staff Sergeant David G. Bellavia distinguished himself by acts of gallantry and intrepidity above and beyond the call of duty on November 10, 2004, while serving as a squad leader in support of Operation Phantom Fury in Fallujah, Iraq. While clearing a house, a squad from Staff Sergeant Bellavia's platoon became trapped within a room by intense enemy fire coming from a fortified position under the stairs leading to the second floor. Recognizing the immediate severity of the situation and with disregard for his own safety, Staff Sergeant Bellavia took up an automatic weapon and entered the doorway of the house to engage the insurgents. With enemy rounds impacting around him, Staff Sergeant Bellavia fired at the enemy position at a cyclic rate, providing covering fire that allowed the squad to break contact and exit the house. A Bradley fighting vehicle was brought forward to suppress the enemy. However, due to high walls surrounding the house, it could not fire directly at the enemy position. Staff Sergeant Bellavia then re-entered the house and again came under intense enemy fire. He observed an enemy insurgent preparing to fire a rocket-propelled grenade at his platoon. Recognizing the grave danger posed by the grenade to his fellow soldiers, Staff Sergeant Bellavia assaulted the enemy position, killing one insurgent and wounding another who ran to another part of the house. Staff Sergeant Bellavia, realizing he had an uncleared, darkened room to his back, moved to clear it. As he entered, an insurgent came down the stairs firing at him. Simultaneously, the previously wounded insurgent reemerged and also engaged Staff Sergeant Bellavia. Staff Sergeant Bellavia, entering further into the darkened room, returned fire and eliminated both insurgents. Staff Sergeant Bellavia then received enemy fire from an insurgent emerging from a closet in the room. Exchanging gunfire, Staff Sergeant Bellavia pursued the enemy up the stairs and eliminated him. Now on the second floor, Staff Sergeant Bellavia moved to a door that opened onto the roof. At this point, a fifth insurgent leapt from the third floor roof onto the second floor roof. Staff Sergeant Bellavia engaged the insurgent through a window, wounding him in the back and legs and causing him to fall off the roof. Acting on instinct to save the members of his platoon from an imminent threat, Staff Sergeant Bellavia ultimately cleared an entire enemy-filled house, destroyed four insurgents, and badly wounded a fifth. Staff Sergeant Bellavia's bravery, complete disregard for his own safety, and unselfish and courageous actions are in keeping with the finest traditions of the military service and reflect great credit upon himself and the United States Army. At this time, the Medal of Honor flag will be presented. On 23 October 2002, Public Law 107-248, Section 8143, established the Medal of Honor flag to recognize service members who have distinguished themselves by gallantry in action above and beyond the call of duty. The Medal of Honor flag commemorates the sacrifice and bloodshed for our freedoms and gives emphasis to the Medal of Honor being the highest award for valor by an individual serving in the armed forces of the United States. The light blue color with gold fringe bearing 13 white stars are adapted from the Medal of Honor ribbon. Ladies and gentlemen, Staff Sergeant David G. Bellavia.
Good afternoon. The Honorable David Norquist performing the duties of Deputy Secretary of Defense. The Honorable Ryan McCarthy performing the duties of Secretary of the Army. Vice Chief of Staff of the Army, General James McConville. Sergeant Major of the Army, Daniel Daly. And my Congressman, the Honorable Chris Collins, U.S. Representative of New York, from New York, Ramrods of 2-2 Infantry. There we go. Family, my mother, my brothers, Dan, Rand, Tim, Deanna, my kids, Evan, Aiden, and Vivian. Thank you for your support. Your presence and my good fortune to be able to share this occasion with my men, my family, my friends, has eased the awkwardness that I'm feeling right now. What's more, I'm especially proud of the recognition that this award brings to my unit, my leaders, and my peers of the mighty Ramrods of 2-2 Infantry, 3rd Brigade, 1st Infantry Division. Combatants bear witness to all aspects of the human condition. It reveals the darkest parts of the human soul, while residing side by side with the most exalted characteristics, nobility, honor, valor, and God's grace. Why do American warriors under fire do what men have done since this nation's inception? This is a common thread that connects the militias of Lexington and Concord with the warriors of Fallujah. It is our love of nation, our way of life, and our love by those who we serve with side by side. We defend, we avenge, we sacrifice, we bleed, and we are willing to die for this unique creation, the United States of America. I am complete for having experienced that kind of sacrifice with my fellow men at arms.
I have to stop this. I mean, honestly, this is what I mean about people who put this stuff together, right? The audio, I mean, the music behind it. Like, are you shitting me? I hate that stuff. He's giving a speech, trust me. And that's some audio geek, like, we're going to heighten the drama of his speech. You don't need to do that. So hold on one second.
Combatants bear witness to all aspects of the human condition.
All right, here's a speech without all that nonsense.
It reveals the darkest parts of the human soul, while residing side by side with the most exalted characteristics, nobility, honor, valor, and God's grace. Why do American warriors under fire do what men have done since this nation's inception? This is a common thread that connects the militias of Lexington and Concord with the warriors of Fallujah. It is our love of nation, our way of life, and our love by those who we serve with side by side. We defend, we avenge, we sacrifice, we bleed, and we are willing to die for this unique creation, the United States of America. I am complete for having experienced that kind of sacrifice with my fellow men at arms and those who died. They gave their lives for me. They gave their lives for you and countless citizens who will never know them. I'm talking about Sims, Falkenberg, Iwan, Gonzalez, Vandenberg, Madison, Garriantes, Schreck, Sizemore, Mock, Rosales, Cardenas, Sprayberry, and Pruitt. Those are our countrymen. Those are our friends. And these men will never get the chance to experience the cycle of life, the birth and growth of their children. They shall not grow old because they chose to stand in our place and face the enemy for us. It's not enough to acknowledge the fallen by name or just inscribe their names in marble as proof that they lived and died. To truly honor the fallen, we must acknowledge how and why they gave their lives. Their death wasn't a random act or a splash of misfortune. These men and women voluntarily put themselves in harm's way, prepared to die so that we may rest secured at home. They are the insurance policy that guarantees that our founding documents, our God-given rights, are more worthy than their own tomorrows. When the news that Falkenberg, Sims, Madison, and Iwan had fallen, the reaction, the shock, the disbelief, the grief, it was transformed into resolve and rage to complete the mission assigned to us and give us even greater tenacity under fire. Their sacrifice gave us clear focus to fight using a reserve that we never knew we had. We broke the will of our adversaries. The enemy was defeated. And because of that, we came home. For the infantrymen in combat, there is nobility and purpose in our lives, and that is unique. But we don't see ourselves as a people apart. We are America's warrior class. We are citizens of the United States and treasure this land more than any overseas posting. The Army provided me with purpose and appreciation for the blessing America has bestowed upon us all. I am forever grateful to the United States Army for making me able to count and cherish those blessings in a way that is unique to most and to those who you wear the uniform. I think my Army has made us all better men, fathers, employees, husbands, and citizens. The controversy that swirled over the Iraq War was not a departure from other wars that America has fought. Just a short distance from where I grew up in Orleans County, on the Canadian side of the Niagara River, it was settled by loyalists who supported King George. With the exception of the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, open dissent has been at the core of our very being, and war has never been particularly a popular undertaking. American soldiers have never confused the United States with Sparta. The best leaders in battle become that way by being loyal and dutiful subordinates. We don't get a vote. We execute the lawful intent of our government. There is no political affiliation on our dog tags. We continue the warrior legacy of the United States without regard for adulation or unanimous approval either. The Iraqi veteran has maintained and in many circumstances far exceeded the highest traditions of military service to this great nation. Of the 1.5 million men and women who have served in Iraq, the valor they displayed was often subsumed by political rhetoric at home. But that in no way diminishes the accomplishment of our troops or the accomplishments of my generation at war. The award is recognition of that, and it should be seen as a validation of our efforts, not as a reward for the action of one individual in one house in Fallujah. When I think of Iraq, I think of Colin Fitz, man shot by three separate weapon systems. Nobody would have raised an eyebrow if Fitzy retired. Instead, Colin Fitz returns to combat duty for two more years to shed more blood for this nation that he loves. When I think of Iraq, I think of Chris Oley, the young saw gunner whose job it is to open doors and put down reflexive fire to people who happen to be shooting back at him. And he was able to do that because behind him was Sergeant Warren Misa, ready to pull him out of that doorway and undoubtedly save his life. I have Chuck Knapp, my team leader. Chuck Knapp saved our entire 3rd Platoon, Alpha Company 2-2, when he stopped us from entering a building-contained IED that would have killed all of us. I think about Max Field, my saw gunner, who asked our Doc Abernathy to fix his injured foot in the prone position so he could continue to knock down targets under fire while he was getting fixed up. My guy John Ruiz, who shielded the body of his buddy from incoming fire without fear of risk to himself. When I think of the Iraq War, I think of Piotr Soholis, brave, strong, and steady. Our engineers, who devised and deployed remarkable weapon systems that saved countless lives. Our tankers, 2-7 Cavalry on the other side of Fallujah, that hardly gets any notice for what they did. There were indispensable Bradley crews who busted through walls. Omar Hardaway, James Cantrell, Chad Ellis, who without a functioning 25mm Bushmaster cannon, or tow, or coax, and let's not discuss how that happened. He used his rifle to suppress the enemy. Corey Brown, the grizzly bear from Montana. Shane Gossard, humble, beautiful, kind. Brad Utesayer, Dalalu, the Bradley teams and those crews are the reason why children have fathers today. And those teams shielded our dismounts from rocket fire that were meant to take our lives. Corey McFadden, John Bandy, Wilson, Gary Fry, Kane. They never took a step backwards under fire. Sergeant John Gregory is one of the toughest, most decent men I've ever served with. He had a tour from hell a year after we came home. Our drivers, Marcotte, Gonzo, Woodbury, Hunter, Perez, they got us there. They needed where we needed to go, and they did it with bravery and valor. Iraq makes me think of Victor Santos, a fiery, brave soldier who cut his combat teeth in Iraq and went on for more in a Ranger regiment. McDaniel and Swanson, young kids shouldering 240 Bravos on their shoulder, suppressing enemy fire from feet away. I had Stuckert, I had Metcalf, I had Flannery and Gross, and I had our door-crushing He-Man, Hugh Hall. That is my Iraq War. And it makes me proud to have told my dad no to dental school. I learned much more from living and fighting with these men than I ever could have from a lifetime of doing root canals. My unit's leaders died leading men from the front. When our company commander, Sean Sims, our company commander, he was killed in a house fight. Joey Seaford and my interpreter, Sammy, who just became a U.S. citizen a week ago. Yeah, you can clap for that. Joey Seaford and my interpreter, Sammy, were there to engage the enemy in efforts to save my company commander's life. Seaford engaged the enemy and threw his weapon at him, engaging him with the buttstock of his rifle after being shot in the shoulder. Travis Barreto and my 1st Platoon fought their way to extract wounded and fallen ramrods under intense enemy fire. My Iraq War, I had Captain, now Colonel, Doug Walter. I had First Sergeant, retired Command Sergeant Major Peter Smith. These were company leaders who put aside loss, put aside trauma, to direct young warriors during the most stressful times of our lives. Young lieutenants like Chris Walls, Jeff Emery, Lieutenant Menno, they learned how to lead and cover down when their peers had fallen. And finally, there's Scott Lawson, a true friend. We lost him in 2013. He entered the house with me that night in Fallujah. He gave me strength. He gave me confidence that allowed me to survive that night and many other nights since then. And I got to mention this guy, Michael Ware, a combat journalist there to cover a story and becomes part of the story. You know, before I got to know him, before I got to see him in action, I would have told you he was 100% worthless and a nuisance. Now that number is 65%. I was wrong. Michael Ware is now the Ernie Pyle of his generation. His reporting is a testament to what we all did. And if it's not for men and women like Michael Ware, our story would have gone unremarked. Most of the men I just described got little or no recognition for their valor. In subsequent deployments, some would lose their lives years later. It is our duty to tell the story of our brave men and women who sacrificed so much for our fellow citizens. As I've tried to communicate to you today, this is not a celebration about me. I'm not mouthing a cliche. We have much more work to do when it comes to the Iraq War veteran. We are not there yet, and we're not even close when it comes to educating our fellow Americans about what was accomplished, what was sacrificed, and what we all went through. Our survival as a nation depends on it. We honor our brothers and sisters in the United States Marine Corps. Anbar Province was their fight. Men like Brad Castle, Rafael Peralta, Christopher Applesberger, Brian Shawntosh, Jeremiah Workman, Sergeant Kraft, they gave the enemy everything they could handle. The Navy and Air Force completed the remarkable display of American valor and might and fought shoulder to shoulder with the United States Army in Fallujah and all over Iraq. This entire military is one cohesive, dedicated force. And the threats to our nations, they don't sleep. They're watching our every move. Iran, Russia, China, North Korea, ISIS, Al-Qaeda. They may be watching this right now. Our military should not be mistaken for a cable news gabfest show. We don't care what you look like. We don't care who you voted for, who you worship, what you worship, who you love. It doesn't matter if your dad left you millions when he died or if he knew who your father was. We have been honed into a machine of lethal moving parts that you would be wise to avoid if you know what's good for you. We will not be intimidated. We will not back down. We've seen war. We don't want war. But if you want war with the United States of America, there's one thing I can promise you, so help me God. Someone else will raise your sons and daughters. We fight so our children never have to. We fight for one day when our children and our enemies' children can discuss their differences without fear or loathing. We fight so that anyone out there thinking about raising arms against our citizens or allies realize the futility of attrition against a disciplined, professional, and lethal force built to withstand anything you can dream of throwing at us. Americans want this kind of country. Americans want this kind of world. And we stand ready to defend it, to protect us. So help us, God. May God bless this beautiful army. May God bless our Marine Corps, our Navy, our Air Force, and Coast Guard. May God bless our allies. And we already know that God blessed America because he gave us the greatest fighting force this world has ever seen, 2-2 Infantry of the 1st Infantry Division. Thank you, Ramrods. Duty first, Dukes. Thank you very much.
We'll end on that. How about that? I'll put the link to that up. And again, the first version I started to play, you can see the music that put to those things by some well-intentioned person. Come on, man. I mean, it's lame. That doesn't need any other audio to go with it, right? That stands on its own. He stands on its own. Yeah, that's pretty cool. Now, I received that from a captain of the Marine Corps. I don't know that I should say his name, but I will. Keegan Kincaid sent that to me. So my thanks to Keegan. That's a great speech. United States Army Staff Sergeant David Bellavilla. And again, that's the speech that goes along with his the presentation of his Medal of Honor flag. So we'll take up the issue of the Confederate artillery and retiring by prologue. And after Lieutenant Colonel McGilvery rides up and says, "Yeah, there's nobody behind you, Bigelow. You got to stay." Yeah, and then there's we'll take that up a different day. But they had like 100 horses devoted to their battery. They got killed. Where'd they get all the horses, man? Did the army roll around with like a horse reserve, or did they take them from people as they went? Yeah, here comes the Union Army. Get the horses out of here. The damn, that is awesome. The CMC should find out who is recruiting in his district and take him to NJP for not getting him in the Marine Corps. His book sold out on Amazon the day he got the medal. Yeah, you know, what's interesting, I mean, it's taken 15 years for him to be awarded that medal. And I believe his medal was upgraded from the Army Cross. Pretty cool, though, right? Ticking off names of Marines. That was motivating. But, no, I mean, his actions during that battle, man. And again, you know, the familiar theme when you hear these things is, I wasn't doing anything I was supposed to be doing, right? I was just taking care of my Marines. I was protecting some, right? I was trying to help others. I was just doing my job. And, you know, as in all Medal of Honors, there's a fair amount of luck that goes involved in it because, as you, everybody knows, the God who governs the flight of metal, why it hit somebody and not somebody else, with as many people as engaged him as and that he engaged, again, but for the grace of God, he's not there, given the situations that all these men and women find themselves involved in. So, I don't think you congratulate people when they win, when they're awarded, they don't win the Medal of Honor. I know that. When they're awarded the Medal of Honor. But, well done. Well done, not only in terms of his own valor and the valor of his unit, his humility in receiving the award, but also, on that speech. It's a great one. That'll do it on a Wednesday. We'll eventually get to to Bigelow and him getting off the battlefield. I actually put a map of it up on. If you go to the read board, you'll see the wheat field. So you've heard me talk about these places, right? Devil's Den, the wheat field, right? Bigelow, the peach orchard, McClaw's Hood. So there's a map that kind of gives a general outline of it. Anyway, have a great day. Don't touch that dial. On a Wednesday, All Marine Radio, over and out.